So let's start with our motivation and have a sense of happiness that we have a precious human life, that we have minds that are intact and senses that are intact, so that we can listen to and think about and meditate on the teachings. And especially to respect and cherish that part of ourselves that has a spiritual yearning, that is seeking something beyond just immediate pleasure, a mind that is interested in spirituality and has encountered the Buddhist teachings. So let's rejoice at all these factors, these and other factors coming together, leading to the present opportunity we have now to listen to the teachings and to contemplate them. And while many of our compatriots on Memorial Day weekend are thinking about war and veterans, we're thinking about how to create a peaceful mind and how to save and cherish life. And so to make our lives really meaningful, let's cultivate the bodhicitta intention to become a fully awakened Buddha, to purify our minds completely, develop all of our good qualities totally, and to do that so that we'll have the wisdom, compassion, and power to be of the greatest benefit to each and every living being, and to have the sensitivity to know how to benefit different people at different times in their life, and then the ability to enact that. So with that long-term motivation, then we're listening to the Buddha's teachings this evening. So for those of you who are here just for the weekend, the Friday night teachings are an ongoing series that we started last August. Yeah? And so every Friday night we have them. We're doing them in this room because we stream them. And there's a number of people who watch them by video or listen by the phone. And you can too in the future. And we've been studying on Friday night the text called the Gomchen Lamrim. So it's one of the Lamrim, or Stages of the Path texts. And last week we just finished the section on the initial level practitioner, with the chapter that talked about karma. And so this week we're just starting the section of the intermediate level practitioner, which begins with the Four Noble Truths, which is better translated as the Four Truths seen by the Arya beings. Because the Four Noble Truths, there's a lot of mistranslation here, but I'll get into that. So, I was thinking, because similarly, the topic for the retreat, you know, how to see yourself as you really are, that book we started teaching how many years ago? 4 maybe? Yeah? And so we're only on page 127, but, and the idea is every year teach it until we finish. But on page 127 starts the meditation on emptiness, which is a practice for advanced level practitioners, and that we aren't supposed to teach people who are brand new to the Dharma. And I know some of you who are here this weekend are brand new to the Dharma. So I was going, what do I do? You know, because there's some people here who have heard this, the teaching on emptiness before, and then there's some people who are brand new. So actually tonight works very well to fill in some of the people who are brand new and to remind some of the people who have heard things before about why we're talking about emptiness. Okay? Because we're beginning the whole section on the four truths seen by the Aryas. The Aryas are beings who know reality directly and non-conceptually. So they've seen these four things as true. And we haven't. And that's part of our problem, is because basically we live in a world of hallucination. But we don't realize we do. I love telling this story from Lama Yeshe when, you know, back in the 70s when people would trudge up the Copan Hill after visiting the dope shop down on Freak Street in the middle of Kathmandu. And somebody would raise their hand and say to Lama, "Lama, what do you think of meditating when you've dropped acid?" And Lama would look and he'd say, "You're already hallucinating, dear. You don't need anything else." Yeah? And it's true, we are hallucinating. Yeah? And this is what the meditation on emptiness is telling us, which we'll get into tomorrow. But why we need to be concerned with this is the topic that we're going through tonight, that we'll begin tonight in talking about the four truths of the Noble Ones. So I'll read a little bit from the text and then, you know, and then comment a little bit. Okay, so the first section here is identifying the aspiration to liberation, because that's what we want to come out of this section of the teachings with, is there's two mental states, actually. One's called renunciation, and one's called the aspiration for liberation, or the determination to be free. Renunciation means that we're fed up with unsatisfactory conditions and we're renouncing them. Okay? The aspiration for liberation means we want to attain full liberation from all of those conditions. So these two go together, you know. We have to leave behind the confused situation that we're in at present and aspire for a state of real peace, of real liberation. Okay? So the text says, not having surpassed the, well, here it says suffering of the humans and gods. Now, here we're getting into another translation issue, because they often translate this, the Pali and Tibetan word dukkha, that is often translated as suffering. And that's a horrible translation, very misleading. The term dukkha actually means unsatisfactory. Yeah, it doesn't mean suffering. And the reason why suffering's a bad translation is because, you know, as we'll get into this evening, we'll talk about what's called the dukkha of change. For example, you know, eating a piece of chocolate cake not being totally satisfactory, yeah? But if you say eating a piece of chocolate cake is suffering, people are going to tell you you're crazy. Okay. So the word, because suffering connotes you're in actual physical pain or very severe mental pain. And that's not the situation. The situation is that things are not satisfactory. Yeah. Sometimes they may be actual suffering. But the basic thing, the basic idea is that no matter what state we're born into as human beings or even in as celestial beings, all these rebirths are basically unsatisfactory because they change all the time. And whatever nice things we have, we lose them. Or we can't get them. Or they're disappointing when we do get them. Okay? So that's why it's better to say dukkha, or unsatisfactory, rather than suffering. Okay, so the text, so when I say dukkha, think unsatisfactory, okay? So not having surpassed the dukkha of humans and gods, nor that of conditionality, you are certain to fall again into a lower rebirth, and the end result can only be grim. So there's different realms of existence within cyclic existence, samsara, this world of constantly recurring problems of continuous rebirth. And so here he's saying that, you know, even we have the good things as humans and gods, if we're still attached to them, we're still sunk into that mode of being, then there's no real peace, because eventually you wind up in an unfortunate rebirth. Okay. One of my teachers, Soka Rinpoche, they took him to the top of the Eiffel Tower, you know, in Paris, and he looked around and he said, oh, this is like being in the highest God realm in samsara. The only place you have to go from here is down. And they got in the, I guess, elevator, whatever it is, and went down. I don't think you walked down the Eiffel Tower. Okay, but that's basically what it's saying here. There's no real security in cyclic existence. And we all would like security, but it keeps eluding us. Anybody here feel completely secure? Yeah. Anybody have financial security? Yeah? I mean, we all want security, but we never kind of have enough to have financial security, or relationship security, or job security, or whatever it is. Yeah? There's always, we know that slight turn of circumstances and whoop, everything goes. Okay. So consequently, you must train in the attitude shared with intermediate beings. Liberation is complete freedom from what binds you to cyclic existence. The desire to attain it is the aspiration to liberation. Okay? And then the text goes into just an overview of these four truths and why they're in the order that they're in. Okay, so the first one is true dukkha. You know, old translation, true suffering. Ugh. You know, true dukkha, the truth that things are unsatisfactory. Then the true origin, yeah, what caused our situation. True cessations, how we stop the unsatisfactory situation and its causes. And true path, the path that we follow to get there. So the first two, you know, true dukkha and true origins are what we want to abandon, and true cessations and true paths are what we want to actualize. Actually, in our monastic robes, there's the symbolism for that. If you have a lot of material, then you put two pleats in the back. Sometimes we don't have enough, so we only have one pleat, but it means two pleats. And so what we want to put behind us is true dukkha and the cause, and then the two pleats in the front here on this side are true cessations and true paths that we want to put in front of us and go towards. So it's an interesting symbolism of our word, of our robes. So the reason that it comes in that order, you know, why does the Buddha talk about unsatisfactory conditions first? I mean, because we all come in and, you know, we want to hear about light and love and bliss and whammo, kazami experiences and levitation and, you know, don't we, you know? You know, you don't want to hear about unsatisfactory conditions. It's like, listen, it's Friday, I just got off of work, I know all about unsatisfactory conditions. You know, I want something that's going to uplift me, you know. And, but the Buddha had to teach this first, because this is our situation. And until we actually see our situation really clearly with eyes of wisdom, we won't have any wish to change it. We'll just keep doing the same old, same old, same old, because we haven't seen its disadvantages. Yeah? So it's kind of like, you know, being in prison. And your prison is kind of comfortable. You know, I mean, it'd be nice to tweak it a little bit, you know, kind of chill the guards out and get some better food. But it's kind of comfortable in your prison, and so you don't have any aspiration to be free. Yeah? Three hots and a cot, and what more do you want? Okay? So that's why, you know, in our present state, we're so ignorant. This is hard to hear, but it's true. We're so ignorant that we don't even see clearly the mess that we're in and the disadvantages of the mess that we're in. And instead, we think we're in this beautiful kind of resort. You know? So it's like somebody who's in prison thinking that they're at a spa. Yeah? Okay. It doesn't work. So that the Buddha had to teach that first so that we know exactly what our situation is and want to abandon it. Wanting to abandon it, then we say, what causes it? Because we need to know what the cause is in order to stop the continuation. So that leads us to the true origins, yeah, to understand what the causes of our situation are. And believe it or not, the cause of our constantly recurring problems is not your boss, it's not Donald Trump, close, but it's really not Donald Trump, you know, and it's not whoever we like to blame for our problems. That's not the origin or the source of our difficulties. The real source is our own ignorance, yeah, a mind that misapprehends how things actually exist. When we look at that ignorance and everything that comes from the ignorance, the afflictions, the karma that causes the rebirth and so on, you know, then we know that to eliminate the unsatisfactory conditions, we have to eliminate the ignorance, the afflictions and the karma. The afflictions and karma are rooted in the ignorance. So then we ask, can ignorance be eliminated? Because if it can, that's good news, you know. But if ignorance cannot be eliminated, then there's no hope. Yeah, we're stuck being ignorant. We're stuck in cyclic existence. The idea why it's called ignorance is because it misapprehends how people and things exist. So people and things exist in a dependent way. They depend on causes and conditions. They depend on parts. They depend on the mind that conceives and labels them. But we don't see them as dependent. We see things as having their own inherent essence, objectively existing out there. It's totally separate from our mind. And we're just coming along and bumping into them. Okay? And this is how we perceive things, right? Yeah? Isn't this? When you're sitting here, doesn't it, everything look like it's some kind of objective world outside of you? You know? You don't think that this, what you're seeing, relates to your mind. Yeah? It's out there. Yeah? Somehow came about, you're not really sure, but it's there. Yeah? And this is a complete misconception. That's not how things exist. And again, you know, due to our ignorance, that we don't even see this fundamental misconception. In fact, we're sure that things are objectively existing out there. Yeah? And I mean, scientists now are bumping up against that assumption. You know, I mean, the famous thing about is the photon a particle or is it a wave? Well, it depends on how you're observing it. You know, this is the kind of thing the Buddha talks about, and it makes people doubt, you know, because everything seems out there objective, you know, and we're just bumping into it. So because ignorance misapprehends things, yeah, it means that that ignorance can be, you know, removed because things do not exist in the way that ignorance thinks they exist. Yeah. So there exists a state of wisdom that can counteract ignorance because wisdom sees things as they are, which is the total opposite of how ignorance sees them. So ignorance sees things as objective, independent, inherent with their own essence. Wisdom sees them as dependent. Yeah? Dependent on many different things, causes and conditions, parts, mutual dependence between things, you know, on the name, on the mind that conceives and names them. So when we're able to develop the ignorance, when we're able to develop the wisdom that sees things as they are, that wisdom can overcome the ignorance. When the ignorance is overcome, then its result, the unsatisfactory conditions, also cease. Okay? So that state of cessation, that is nirvana or liberation, that's the third truth. You know, that's what we want to actualize. And then the path leading to that, you know, that path of wisdom, that's the last one, the true paths. So it's interesting when you look at the Four Noble Truths, you have dukkha and its origin, cessation, and then the path leading to that. So what you have is actually first the result and then its cause. And then that's on the afflictive side, the samsaric side. And then you have true cessation and true path. So what we want to actualize and then how we're going to do it. And so we might think, you know, well, usually you present the cause and then the effect. How come the Buddha did it upside down here and did the effect first and then the cause? Well, it's because there's this whole psychological method of leading us on in that direction. And so we have to start out looking at our situation, then seeking its cause, then figuring out that the cause can be eliminated and there exists a state of peace, true cessation, and then practicing the path, which is that wisdom realizing reality, which will overcome the ignorance. Okay? So they say the dukkha is to be overcome, the origin, the dukkha is to be known, its origin is to be overcome, true cessations are to be actualized, and true paths are to be practiced or cultivated. So there's a different way that we relate to each of these four truths. Then the text goes into the actual meditation on dukkha, okay? And if you're somebody who likes lists, this section, well, Buddhism as a whole has lots of lists. If you like numbers and lists, you're a Buddhist. or should be. Okay, because we start talking about the different kinds of dukkha. So there's the eight kinds, and the three kinds, and the six kinds. Okay, and we're going to start off talking about the eight. And each of these eight have five branches. So, you know, we have 40 points to meditate on altogether here. And, you know, some people really, they don't like this section of the Lamrim. Because like I said, you know, they want to hear light, live, love, bliss, you know, kind of something that makes you feel good and, you know, I'll be enlightened by next Wednesday and, you know, something like this. And instead, you know, what do we have? You know, we start talking about, you know, birth, sickness, aging, death, you know, not getting what you want, being separated from what you like, getting what you don't want, and then the whole mess of samsara, and people are going, I don't want to hear this. Okay. But we actually have to hear it, because like I said, if we're in prison and we don't see ourselves as somebody trapped in prison, we're not going to want to get out. Yeah? And, you know, in the time that I've been practicing and sharing the Dharma with others, what I really see with people is we have a lot of resistance to really looking at what our situation is. You know? Because we grew up in the free world. I don't know how free it is, but that's the term. We grew up in the free world. We grew up, most of us here, after World War II. Yeah, during the Eisenhower years for us dinosaurs and, you know, when America's booming and the economy's booming, and okay, there was a recession in 08, but it was nothing like the depression of 1928. And, you know, a recession in this country, you know, I mean, to be considered under the poverty, if you don't have a television in this country, you know, you're considered under the poverty line. Yeah, for many countries in the world, forget about television. Yeah, I mean, they're living on hardly anything in the world. But, you know, we always compared to what is immediately available to us. And we're told we grew up in the land of the free and the home of the brave, and that we're entitled to have everything and be happy. And there's tremendous societal pressure to be happy. Do you feel pressure to be happy? You know, from your peers, from your family. If you go and visit your family and they say, how are you? And you say, oh, not so good. Well, what's wrong with you? You know, you should be happy. Do any of you encounter that problem with your family or your friends? Yeah, kind of, you're supposed to be happy and something's wrong with you if you're not. And yet, you know, the truth is that none of us are completely, perfectly happy. If we were, we wouldn't be here. We would be off with our eternal source of happiness. Which we've never encountered, have we? Yeah, we keep looking for our eternal source of happiness. We keep thinking the next thing around the corner that we got is it. But we've never succeeded really in finding it. Yeah. I remember my parents worked really, really hard. They wanted so my dad could retire early, you know, because then that's the ultimate bliss. You can retire in your 50s and then, wow. And then he retired, he didn't know what to do with himself. Yeah? So, I mean, this kind of thing happens all the time, doesn't it? That we're looking for eternal happiness and we can't seem to find it anywhere. So we have to really study this circumstance and see what our situation is and not be afraid to look. And like I said, this is one of the major blocks I see many of us in the West having to really progressing on the path. Because we don't really want to confront the truth of our present situation. Because when you do, it's really uncomfortable. Yeah. But we're going to do it. And we're going to start hearing the teachings about it. Okay, so the eight types of dukkha. Yeah. So we start out with birth, aging, sickness, death. Okay, common to everybody, right? Let me make sure I get the next order. Encountering the undesirable, so getting what we don't want, being separated from what we do like, yeah, not getting what we want, and then just the whole situation of being born in a body and mind that are under the control of ignorance and afflictions. So let's go back to the beginning of these and look at birth. Yeah, we'll start with birth. Now, in our culture, we see birth as good, right? Somebody's having a baby, yippee! Yeah, isn't that fantastic? There's, you know, somebody's having a baby and there's new life, okay? The thing is that birth is the cause of death. Isn't it? Yeah. Why do we die? Because we're born. So it's kind of weird that we say birth is so wonderful, but we don't like death when birth is the actual cause of death. We also, in our culture, we think of birth, we romanticize birth very much. Yeah, we forget that a woman is in labor and they call it labor for a reason. Yeah, because it's the hardest work that you ever do. So I've heard, I don't have personal experience. Is it the hardest work you've ever done? Yeah, I must feel like you're splitting open. Yeah? And this thing is coming out, and you don't know who it is, and they're moving in for the next 40 years. Yeah? And they start out going, aah! They don't say, oh, thank you for having me, you know? We turn them upside down, whack them on the bottom, and they go, and we say, oh, isn't it beautiful? Okay? In the teachings, they say birth is associated with physical pain, you know, for the mother and for the child. Now, I can't remember my birth, but my mother so delightfully told me that, because I was the first child, that if it's good that she couldn't remember how horrible and horribly painful my birth was, because if she did, she wouldn't have had my brother. Yeah, these are treasures from my mom. I'm going to write a book sometime. That's the title, Treasures from Mom. Okay? Yeah, so, you know, because she was lying there in labor in those days, you know, they wouldn't let the husband in there, as if the husband could do anything anyway. So my dad was going to, he was bowling. This is 1950, you know? It's Chicago, so he's bowling. because they wouldn't let him in the thing, you know. And so mom's in the bed, and she was up a few stories, and she said she felt like jumping out, but they had bars on the side of the bed, you know, I guess to prevent the women in those days from jumping out the window. Yeah. And I can't imagine what it would be like. I mean, you know, in some countries where, you know, where there's a breech birth, or where there's, you know, you need a cesarean, or anybody here had a cesarean? Yeah, not painful. Yeah, you know, and so you know, it's painful for the mother, and they say it's also painful for the child, because the child, you know, we have our big fat heads, and you know, we come out of the womb with swollen heads, and you know, we're going through this very narrow passage. We have no clue in the world what's going on. You know, we're being pushed and shoved and pulled, and you know, it's cold, and you know, and then when we finally get out, like I said, they turn us upside down and whack us, and we have no clue, no understanding of what's happening, and just this incredible, the physical sensations that are very painful, apparently, and scary, even though we like to romanticize it and, you know, think that it's nice. But even the doctors call it, you know, when they monitor the baby, they'll say the baby is in distress. Yeah? Okay, so birth, associated with physical pain. Second one, associated with dysfunctional tendencies. Nice vocabulary word. What this means is seeds or predisposing tendencies, like latencies, for the afflictions, and for creating a polluted karma. Okay? So just the process of taking birth under the influence of the afflictions, we have these tendencies to act with afflictions. Okay, third is birth is the basis for all the other kind of physical dukkha or physical suffering that we experience. Here suffering fits. That we experience in our life, because birth gives rise to aging, to sickness, to death. Without birth, none of the other ones happen. Okay, so that's the third quality of birth. The fourth one is that it's the basis for all the afflictions. In other words, once we're born under the influence of ignorance, we have afflictions in our mind, especially ignorance, anger, and attachment, and these constantly disturb our mind and make us confused and make us unhappy. You know, from the time we're itty-bitty. Yeah, I mean, babies have attachment, don't they? They have anger, they have confusion. And these kind of emotions torment their mind, just as, you know, we adults, you know, we're in the same situation. Okay, that's the fourth. And then the fifth is that it is dukkha, it's unsatisfactory, because it's going to result in unwanted separation, in other words, death. Yeah? Once you're born, the only certain thing is death. Everything else that happens between birth and death is optional, actually. You know, or maybe not optional, but may or may not happen, because some beings die immediately after, you know, conception. Okay, so they say, you know, really, meditate on these five attributes of birth so that we get a sense of, like, this is not a great situation. You know, do I really want to keep being reborn in samsara again and again and again and having to go through this again and again and again? Okay. Then the second one was aging. So aging also has five qualities, and we meditate on each one of these qualities individually, and really, you know, think about it, make many examples from our life. You know, if you've ever watched somebody give birth, it's painful, yeah? And, you know, you go through and look at these five characteristics. Then same with aging, okay? So what happens with aging, first of all, is that our attractive body declines. And I always find it so interesting because our society idolizes youth and good looks, and we're all becoming older and uglier. Aren't we? So it's crazy making, because our society is telling us we should look younger and more attractive, but no one is becoming that. No one is becoming younger. Everybody's getting older. Nobody's getting more attractive. Everybody's aging. And aging, you know, your attractiveness decreases, doesn't it? You know, no matter how much Botox you have, how many facelifts. I was really reading an article now, not too long ago, and that a lot of men are going for Botox treatments now. Yeah, because they want to look really good, and they're dyeing their hair. They used to say women are vain, but now men are doing the exact same things. Okay? So, you know, no matter what you do to try and prevent aging, it's happening, isn't it? You know? And the wrinkles are coming, and the body's sagging, and the energy's going, and that's it. And it's happening to all of us, and there's no way to prevent it. The only way to prevent aging is to die. And that's not really a good option, is it? You know, we'd rather age than die. But that's the reality of aging, okay? The second is our strength and our vigor also wanes. So we used to be so energetic and we can go do this and go do that and full of energy and vitality, and now it's like, let's see if I can make it up the stairs. Okay? Or used to be able to talk, and now, you know, it's hard finding the words. We can't really express ourselves so well. Yeah? True or not true? Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Yeah, the strength of our body wanes. Okay? And third is our senses deteriorate. So, you know, my theory is actually my eyesight isn't getting worse. I think they shrink the size of the letters each year. Yeah. Yeah. Don't you think they shrink the size of the letters? Yeah, my eyesight's completely good. They just shrink the letters, you know. Yes, they make it dimmer, they shrink the letters, and everybody mumbles nowadays. But this time, they really do mumble. They really do mumble. Yeah, that one's, I'm sure. Yeah, because when I went to Europe, I could understand what people said, and I come to the Abbey, and they're all going like this. They start out a sentence like this, and then it ends like this, and then they talk like this. So I really think that one's not totally my decrepit body. What do you think? You're making a face at me. Okay. So our senses deteriorate. You know, seeing isn't as good. Hearing isn't as good. Smelling isn't, tasting, you know. Yeah, physical sensations. Your sex drive goes away, then you have to go get Viagra or whatever they were trying to invent for women, you know. And I don't know. I think it's a blessing when your sex drive gets you know, calms down. You know, it's much easier. You know, but a lot of people don't like, oh, let's go and find something. Okay, four is your enjoyment of sex, of sense objects. Well, it would have gone, it fits that way too. Yeah. Yeah. Your enjoyment of sex or sense objects. Okay. Lessons. Yeah. It decreases, doesn't it? Yeah. Somehow, you know, the food isn't, you can't taste it as well. I remember meeting one lady when I lived in Italy, and she was an older woman, and she said, you know, I can't taste food as well, and I feel like there's such a loss in my life, and I really want to have a good appetite and enjoy food again. And I'm sitting there thinking, that sounds like the cause to be reborn as a hungry ghost, you know, don't think like that. But, you know, she was really unhappy because she couldn't taste food as well, you know. And then you can't smell as well. Yeah, physical sensations aren't as well, you know, as well. You become, what is it called, incontinent, you know. Then you have to wear a diaper. Then you have your children reminding you to wear your diaper. Yeah. When my dad came to the Abbey, 2010. And when he came in 2010, and then I traveled back to Southern California where he lives. And my dad's incontinent, and he doesn't want to wear his diaper. And I'm like, Dad, you know, do you have to go to the bathroom? Why are you always asking me if I have to go to the bathroom? I'm a grown man. I know when I have to go to the bathroom. Well, Dad, you don't always know, and we're on the airplane. You know, so it was a very difficult thing trying to do that. Eventually, he had enough accidents that he started to do it himself, you know, to wear the diapers. But, you know, you become incontinent, you can't walk so well, you can't do so much for yourself, yeah. Things ache, yeah. We get aches and pains when we're older. Okay, so all of that kind of thing, the body just is degenerating. Okay, and then the fifth one is, you know, life degenerates. Yeah, so that's what I was just talking about, you know, body degenerates, pleasure degenerates, energy declines. Yeah, and they say that it's good that we age gradually, because if you were to, you know, one day look in the mirror, and you know, when you're in your 20s or something, and look in your mirror, and then there's the face of what you look like when you're, you know, in your 70s or 80s or whatever, that you would, you know, fall over in shock. Yeah. And I think so. Yeah, that it would be very, very shocking to look in the mirror when you're young and see what you're going to look like when you're old. It's shocking even when you're old and you look in the mirror and see, who is that person? You know, that doesn't look like the pictures of me in the scrapbook, you know? Okay, so, you know, that's what aging is. And, you know, especially I think in our culture, aging is so difficult. Because in old cultures, they respected the aged, you know? We don't respect the elderly, yeah? They're out of it, yeah? They don't know how to use the newest widget, yeah? It's like, what button do I push to turn this thing on, yeah? And when you're older, whenever you need somebody to open one of those bottles, you know, like an aspirin bottle. You have to find a three-year-old who can do it, you know, because you can't do it anymore. So, yeah, you really see that, you know, people don't respect you, they push you aside. My sister is 50. She looks much younger. But she said she's really noticed the last few years how even going into stores, she can't get a salesperson's attention as easily as she used to. Yeah, when you're younger, the salespeople pay attention to you. When you're older, it's like, okay. I personally speaking, I think elderly people are fascinating because they live through periods of time before I was born, so they can tell me what it was really like in those times, which is very different than reading about it in a book, you know, and asking people what they've learned from living however many years they've learned. I think it's quite fascinating and really interesting to talk to elderly people. But in general in our society, you know, kind of you're old. And the thing that's so weird about this is you're old, you're over the hill, but so say the 20-somethings. And then in another few years, they're the ones who are over the hill. But whatever age you are, you don't feel like you're the ones who are over the hill. You feel like you're the one who is young and vital and have your life in front of you, you know, until you can't do what you used to be able to do, and then it starts coming to you, okay? So I think a lot, there's not only the physical thing, but the psychological thing of adjusting to looking old, having other people look at you as, you know, over the hill, useless, not respecting what you've learned in your life, or whatever. Yeah, so that causes a lot of suffering. The purpose in talking about all these things is not to make us depressed, like, oh, I'm going to get old, and like, what's going to happen to me, and like that. The purpose of learning about this is so that we see clearly what samsara is, so that then we will develop the determination to be free of it. Okay, that's what the purpose is. So the purpose of all this talk is not to make us depressed. We can do that very fine by ourselves. Okay, you don't need to come here to learn how to be depressed. The purpose of learning this is so that we see very clearly, you know, as when I crave rebirth in cyclic existence, this is what is part of the deal. And there's no way to get that, the deal, without this coupon, you know, without this condition. It's part of the bag, yeah. Okay, then the next one. So we had birth, aging, then sickness. Okay, the five points about sickness. First is, you know, our body transforms, you know, our skin dries out, our flesh wastes away, we're, you know, yeah. When you're sick, your body doesn't look like it used to, does it? And doesn't feel like it's used to. You know, it's so interesting because we so often see people, most of the people we see is after they've taken a shower and gotten dressed and they step out the front door and they look like you're supposed to look. But how many people do we see before they've done that? Yeah? And how many people do we see when they're sick and they feel really cruddy? And what do they look like then? Okay, so there's the physical transformation. The second is the mental anguish. Because there's, you know, the body, the physical elements are out of whack. So we feel sick, we feel awful. Then mentally we get out of whack. Mentally we start worrying, we get fearful, we have anxiety. You know, how many of you, when you feel sick, feel anxious, you know, and think that you're probably going to die in the next few days? Yeah, I mean, our mind just kind of takes the ball and runs with it. Yeah, I have a cold. Is it going to be pneumonia? Yeah, I have, you know, some small thing, and it's like, it must be cancer. I know I'm dying. Yeah. So the mental pain that comes out of attachment to the body is something tremendous too. Okay. The third one is when we're sick, we have no desire for attractive things. You know, it's like, I'm sick. I don't care about chocolate cake. I don't care about the football game. I don't care about, you know, you graduated this or that. You know, when you're sick, you don't care about much, do you? Just about how lousy you feel. Okay? So there's no desire for attractive things. And anyway, even if there were, most of them are bad for you when you're sick, so you can't take them. And then four is when you're sick, you have to undergo all sorts of unpleasant treatment. So you have to take medicine that has side effects. You have to have surgery, which isn't, you know, our idea of a fun Saturday. You know, you have to have the treatment, and the treatment is often quite painful and uncomfortable, and you're never quite sure if the treatment's going to be successful or not. Okay, so there's that part. And then fifth is, you know, at the end of the illness, there's, you know, at the end of some illness, we lose our life. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, on death certificates, it doesn't matter how old you are. They never put the cause of death as old age, because you there's always some other circumstance. You know, you caught a cold and it turned into pneumonia. You know, that's how my mom died. My dad choked on a piece of meat at his birthday party. You know, it happens, and so there's always something, some disease, some physical injury or something that is the actual cause of death. Okay, then the suffering of death, the dukkha of death, also has five aspects. So primarily the problem with death is that it's separation. Yeah? And it's a kind of separation that we can't undo. You know, in our life, when we're separated from something, we can try and try and try and get it back. Often we can't. But at death, it's gone. Okay? So we separate from our body at death. You know, this thing that we've had since life, since birth, this thing that we pamper, that we think is the cause of so much happiness and bliss, this thing that we're trying to give so much pleasure to, that we're preoccupied with. You know, it's very interesting to look at one day and how much time you spend either thinking about your body or doing something to protect your body or giving your body pleasure or freeing your body from pain. You know? Out of 24 hours, I don't know. Most of them, I think, are fussing around our body. Yeah? Why do you go to work? To earn the money, to get the food, to feed the body, to keep the body alive. Then you have to go get clothes, you know? I mean, and then you have to have a certain kind of car nowadays, yeah? So you have to have your job so that you can take care of your body. Then you have to have certain clothes that illustrate the caliber of people who have that kind of job. And you have to drive a certain kind of car. And you have to have a certain kind of spouse and have certain kind of hobbies. And, you know, you're squishing yourself into some pre-programmed thing, trying to keep yourself alive and make sure this body's okay. Yeah. Several of us did nune last weekend, and on the second day of the nune, you don't eat or drink or speak. Yeah. So you have a totally different relationship to your body that day. Yeah. Then if you feel like, gee, this body is such a nuisance, you know? It's like, it always wants something. It's always dissatisfied, you know? It's like my meditation cushion is too hard, yeah? Or I'm bowing and, you know, it's hitting my forehead, or, you know, always, yeah? So anyway, this body that is kind of a hassle, we're still very attached to. And at the time of death, it's gone. This is the big betrayal of our life, that this body that we work so hard to please dies on us. Yeah, we have to separate from it. Second, we separate from our belongings. You know, all your scrapbooks and family photos, yeah, all your diplomas and certificates, all the decorations in your house that make it feel familiar. Yeah, everything you work so hard in your life to get at the time of death stays here. It all stays here. Our consciousness goes on alone. And then other people go through your stuff. Do you really want other people going through your underwear drawer? Yeah, and they go through all your files. You know, who knows what in the world you saved in your file cabinet. You know, and people are pulling it out and, you know, reading it. Yeah, they look through everything you have. And to them, it is all junk. Or most of it is, anyway. And they go, why, you know? I'm executor of this person's stuff. Why did they save this stuff? You know, and especially, you know, if we're kind of pack rats and, you know, you have file folders full of receipts from, I don't know how many years ago. Yeah, I had a friend who, they had a neighbor down the street, an old woman who had died. She didn't have any family, so they wound up being the executors of the wills. You know, there was the executor of the estate, I think. I don't know if she even had a will. They had to go through all this stuff, you know, envelopes full of receipts, yeah? And, I heard another person, you know, they had to go through somebody's stuff all full of used, you know, Kleenex. And, yeah? I mean, think about what your house looks like. Do you want somebody, right now, if somebody were to go through all your stuff and see what you had, would you be embarrassed at all? I don't know. Anyway, you're separating from them. When you die, that's it. Okay? You go on. Your belongings here stay here. Your money goes here. And then your relatives fight over it. And it's true. Yeah. I used to say this all the time in, you know, when I taught, because I would watch other people's family. And I always said, this isn't going to happen in my family. It happened in my family. It was shocking, you know? Anyway, so your belongings you separate from. Your dear relatives, yeah? All your blood relatives who you've known since you were born or who you gave birth to or whatever, you separate from all of them, yeah? Fourth is your friends, your companions, the people who understand you, you separate from them. And then fifth is just all the mental and physical pain and anguish of dying and, separating from this body. So death is not something we look forward to, unless you're a very skilled meditator and realized meditator. Then they say death is like going on a picnic. Yeah, but for most of us, it's like, you know, our whole ego identity, everything what we spent years building up, you know, this is who I am. Look at my Facebook page, and I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm on Instagram, and I'm on Pinterest, and I'm on this and that and the other thing, and this is who I am. Except when we die, we're not any of that. You know, all of our accounts stay there, and, you know, we're experiencing something totally different. Yeah. Meanwhile, you know, on your Facebook, oh, there was such a lovely person, so sad that they died, you know. Because when you die, everybody has to say nice things about you, no matter what they said behind your back while you were alive. When you die, then they have to say nice things, you know, because it's not really too polite to say bad things about the dead, unless you whisper them to other people who also think the same way, you know. And, you know, in the back of the mortuary, you know, there's a few people hanging out. Yeah. I remember my cousin. I have an interesting family. My cousin was from Chicago, getting married to a woman who lived in California, and my aunt, my uncle was already dead, my aunt was coming out, and they were all at the bride's house the morning of the wedding, and the wedding was going to be a big thing, and music, and the whole shebang, okay? And the morning of the wedding, they find my aunt dead in the bathtub. Okay? So everybody's kind of shocked. They're trying to organize a wedding and a funeral at the same time. And I remember at the wedding, you know, one of my uncles, you know, who, you know, very practical lawyer type of person, pulling aside my cousin, who was the groom, who's, you know, not only the thing of getting married, but his mother dying on that day, and starting to talk about it, to him about, well, you know, we have to do the will like this, and this, and this is how we're going to divide it, and I'll help you, and, you know, blah, 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 and started talking about how to divide all the property. It was really quite something. I remember watching that, you know. Yeah, so, you know, probably in the memorial that they have for us, there's probably going to be a couple of people in the back, you know, like, yeah, she was a pretty nice person, but boy, sometimes she drove me crazy. Yeah? I mean, do you think when you die, everybody's just going to go, oh, this is so wonderful. Almost a Buddha. Yeah. No, because why did she die today? I'm so stressed out. Couldn't she have died later? You know, we have so many things going on at the Abbey today.
She's on dishes.
Yeah. She's on dishes and she knocked over. What?
That's inconsiderate.
Yes, that's very inconsiderate, isn't it? Just when there's knapweed to pull, you know? they die on us before pulling the knapweed.
Or a compost toilet seat.
Oh, yes. No, when I die, they're all going to go, she's going to rejoice. Oh, good, now I don't have to deal with the compost toilet anymore. there's no running water in my cabin, so. Okay. Anyway, back to death here. Yeah. You know, when you think of it, you know, we spend our whole life building up an image and a personality and, a thing of this is who I am. And at the time we die, poof, you know, it's gone. And all these things, you know, that we treasured, that we thought were so important, yeah, everybody's just going to rummage through and throw away and, you know, really kind of something. Okay, then the next one. Where are we? It's 8:30. 7:30. Maybe let's stop and see if there's questions or comments. Yeah, before I go on. Anything else? Questions, comments? Yeah?
So this might be a good time to remind people that they can make donations for the
Okay. Any other comments? Yeah. It seems like, doesn't it? Are not, some people may be more attached to their bodies, some people more to their relatives, some people more to their possessions, some people more to their image, you know? But everybody, you know, most people anyway, are very attached to their lives. And people will do almost anything to preserve their life. Yeah, but what's interesting is people will give up their life for matters of honor. Yeah, that honor for many people is more important than life. That's why you have honor killings. That's why you have so many fights and quarrels over stuff that is really inconsequential because it has to do with image and honor and self-respect.
Mm-hmm. People were willing to give up their life for honor killings. Is an honor killing somebody else because of your honor?
Yeah, an honor killing is usually killing somebody else because of your honor. But people will die on account of their own honor. Right. Yeah, and that's I was saying both things using that same term. But yeah, when somebody insults us. You know, we will stick up for our honor even to the point of getting killed, often. Yeah?
When we meditate, do we meditate on all the four topics or focus on one at a time?
You start with the first one and go through the 5 points and, you know, then really focus, you know, when you reach a conclusion, hold that in your mind, then go on to the next one. And do the 5 points, you know, really thinking about each of the 5 points, you know, and making sure that you come, your conclusion is, you know, this is part of the nature of cyclic existence, and I don't want to keep going through this. I want liberation. Yeah, is there another? Say that again.
So if one can understand the difference between needing air to breathe and wanting air to breathe, and then holding on to the needs and letting go of the wants, one finds the form of emptiness?
One finds the what of emptiness?
Form of emptiness.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, you're... if we start letting go of wants, that's a step in simplifying our life. Yeah. And not causing ourselves so many problems. But that doesn't have to do with necessarily. If you've realized emptiness, yes, you'll let go of not only wants, but probably needs too. But just letting go of wants doesn't mean that you've realized emptiness. But it is definitely helpful. Yeah?
When I birth, what is the main difference between the second and third point? They seem very similar.
Under which one?
Birth.
Under birth? Okay. So birth, your second point is associated with dysfunctional tendencies, and the third point is that it's the basis of all other misery in that life, like aging, sickness, and death. Okay, so the third one is, you know, it's the basis. Once you're born, you have aging, sickness, and death. The second one is that you're gonna have, you know, these dysfunctional tendencies, which make it very difficult for your mind to create virtue. Okay? Because these tendencies, these latencies, kind of push us towards confusion. Yes, yeah.
I was remembering, I think it was in 400 stanzas of Aryadeva, that he's saying that we are very funny human beings. We want to live long, but we don't want to age.
Yes.
And we want, I think that was probably your comment, I don't remember, but yeah. We want to eat, but we don't want to take out our food.
Yeah. 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 We want the good side of everything, but we have to accept that once you get that, you also, you know, we don't want to die, but we don't want to age, but it means you can't have both. Yeah? So, and this is the thing with samsara, we're always trying to get both. Yeah? We don't want to accept the limits of samsara. We want to think that there's got to be some way to tweak my samsara, to make it so that this is really good, that I'm never going to experience misery. Yeah? We're just like, there's got to be some way to do it. And when we think that, what is the definition of samsara? It's taking the five aggregates under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and polluted karma. When that's what samsara is. When we look at that and really say that's the definition of samsara, then we see there's not going to be any way ever to tweak our samsara and finally make it good, and finally make it secure and satisfactory. There's no way to do it.
Is there any danger in meditating on these topics if you don't have a strong belief in rebirth?
Danger in meditating on these topics if you don't have a strong belief in rebirth. You might, you know, kind of start just feeling depressed, you know, because if you don't have this vision of what samsara is, then when you start thinking about what our life is, and you don't, if you put it this way, if you don't believe in rebirth, your whole vision of life ends in death. So then whenever you think of your problems, it's problems or death, which is not a very pleasant way to live. You know, it leads you really stuck.
I don't think so, though. I think the other option is you really don't know. Not like one or the other, it's you just don't know.
Mm-hmm. But having an option, but feeling like I don't know what happens after death, that also leaves you hanging.
I know, that's what's really very difficult. I don't disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but his point is if you have some idea of what samsara is, and that fits into your belief system, then when you think about all these conditions that we face in samsaric life, you realize there's an alternative. And you realize there's quite a wonderful alternative. But if you don't have that understanding of rebirth and liberation and freedom from cyclic existence, then there's nothing to look forward to, nothing to hope for, nothing to work towards. Yeah?
I think the basis of my question is this is the intermediate stage mm-hmm. we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so should they skip? Perhaps this is some of the reason why many people in the West don't like to meditate on this, because they don't see any good that would come out of it. Perhaps that's the reason. Yeah, but I think should they skip meditating on this? Maybe. But the thing is, you know, if you don't have a belief in rebirth, you might skip this. And you can still benefit from meditating on a lot of the things in the bodhisattva part of the path. But you're going to have to block out some of that too, because really understanding bodhicitta, to really get what bodhicitta is about, you have to have that awareness of what samsara is, which means you have to have some understanding of what rebirth is. Yeah. But for people who don't believe in rebirth, there's no pressure to believe in it. Okay? But it's good to just kind of check up and keep asking yourself questions. And His Holiness's view is, if you are not really sure if there's rebirth or not, but you live like there is, and it turns out that there isn't, you haven't lost anything. But if you live like there isn't rebirth, and it turns out that there is, then you're in trouble. Yeah? So, you know, it's just something, because if you live like there's rebirth, then you're going to keep good ethical conduct, you're going to have clean relationships and forgive people and apologize to them, and you're not going to hold grudges to other people, you're going to try and be kind. I mean, just basic practices that even make you happier in this life, you can do if you just have the assumption that there's rebirth. So it doesn't hurt. Yeah? Whereas if you assume that there's no rebirth, then, you know, and it turns out there is. Okay. One of the things that I think makes it difficult for us to think about rebirth is the appearance of this life is so strong, and our self-grasping is very strong. And we only can conceive of ourselves as being who we are right now. Yeah. We can't even conceive of ourselves being an infant. Yeah. Can you think of yourself as being an infant? Having the mind of an infant? Can you even imagine that? Like, you know, an infant's confusion, not knowing what's going on, having this body that, you know, because babies, they don't even recognize these things that are flailing as part of their own bodies. They're afraid of their own cries because they don't realize they're making them. Yeah, can we even conceive of ourselves as being an infant? Very difficult. And yet we know we have been. Yeah. So doesn't that tell us something about how glued we are to the to whoever we think we are right now, and that maybe that's a wrong notion? Yeah, just maybe this feeling of, you know, I can only be who I am right now, maybe that's not correct, because we all know we were infants. Yeah, even though we can't imagine having been one. And can we even imagine being, you know, 90 years old? Yeah, can you imagine looking in the mirror? Oh my goodness. And then looking here, and it's 90 years old, and everything hurts, and your mind's confused? Yeah, can we even imagine what that's like? No, but it's a very real possibility. So to me, this says that our present, the vision of our present self-grasping, that I am this person who I am now, and I always have been, and I always will be, it's very direct proof that that notion that I cling on to is erroneous. It's wrong. You think? So then, shouldn't we, you know, if we can see that how we're seeing things is wrong, wouldn't it be wise to maybe stretch the mind a little bit, start to consider some other possibilities? Yeah? Seems like it would make sense to do that. Yeah.
You started talking about depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we ponder ourselves as a 90-year-old with the failing of all our senses and everything else without getting depressed?
When I do it, why do we get depressed? Because there's attachment to being young and vibrant and healthy, you know? When I think, if I live so long, may I be kind. I'm not going to be young and vibrant and healthy, but may I be kind. Yeah? And may I have a deep connection with the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And may I have a way of, even in small ways, making my life meaningful by giving to other people. Yeah, that's possible when we're 90 years old. Our body can be falling apart, but, you know, we can still be kind. We can still listen to Dharma teachings. We can still, you know, make our lives meaningful to others. Yeah? I mean, wouldn't it transform you if you had some relative who was 90 years old? Who could laugh at how they were failing, and who was just kind and gracious and concerned about other people, wouldn't that really impress you? Yeah, it would impress me. Yeah? So that person still has something to give. And even if you have nothing to give, or even if you have a lot of to give but nobody recognizes it, if you've built a strong meditation practice, you can still practice. Your body's falling apart, your mind's like cuckoo, but you know, there's still some way to practice taking and giving, isn't there? There's still some way to be kind. So,
we can see, you know, we can see possibly ourselves, most probably, fast forward 25 years, we're 65, they're 90, and they're poof, so you can not wait those years, and so
sucks to be old at times. It's not easy. And that's the best thing. We just try to embrace them
with
hugs and kisses and let them know we love you and we care.
Yeah.
We can't make it better, necessarily, your physical condition.
Mm-hmm.
And we do love you.
Yeah.
That's the best, that's the most wonderful thing you can do.
Right. And I'm sure they appreciate that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's for somebody who doesn't know the Dharma. Imagine what you could do if you know the Dharma. Yeah? I look at my teachers. I mean, His Holiness is going to be 81 this year. Yeah, wow.
Or Jeffrey.
Yeah, and Jeffrey.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, Jeffrey's showing us what it's like to age and deteriorate. Yeah. But, I look at my teachers and hell the problems, this problem, that problem. Boy, they have such a passion for teaching. They have so much to that they want to give. And they feel that their lives are quite meaningful. Hmm. Yeah, even one of my teachers, Khenpo Jumpa Tekchok, who died almost a year and a half ago. He was sick for the last few years of his life, and I mean really ill. He used to be this quite large man, and he became quite thin and very, very ill. And even I'd go see him, and he wasn't cheerful like he used to be. But he was still teaching me, everything I saw watching him as he was aging was a big teaching for me. Mm-hmm.
I think one of the mental factors that I really want to cultivate at the time of death is an intense gratitude for what this life has given me.
Yeah.
That's a great mind to have.
Yeah. A mind of gratitude. Yep, as you're aging and seeing how fortunate we've been and rejoicing. Yeah, really rejoicing at our life instead of like, oh, I'm losing everything. Like, wow, how fortunate I've been. Because when you look, I mean, our lives have been amazingly fortunate. Especially, if you've had the opportunity to practice the Dharma for a while. Amazingly fortunate.
I just wanted to, something you just talked about your teachers as they age, how they still practice. Just give an example of Jigdal Bachchan Sakya Rinpoche, who just died.
Of who?
Jigdal Bachchan Sakya Rinpoche.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he sat there, and through those months, I learned so much about his commitment that he just kept showing up. Whether he said anything or did anything, he kept showing up to the point they're carrying him on a wheelchair.
Yeah, yeah. So Jigdal Sakya Rinpoche of Sakya Monastery in Seattle kept coming, and he was another one who was sick long time deteriorating, and he would show up every Sunday morning to do Chenrezig practice. Even they have to carry him in, and what you learned, by that example is you do your practice no matter what, and it helps you no matter what, and he was showing up for his students too. That compassion that he had to show up for his students. Hmm?